Hello and welcome to this, the final episode in the Innovation Forum Ethical Trade and Human Rights webinar series. I'm Ian Welsh and I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so. Following on from our sessions yesterday and earlier today, we're continuing to start off some of the conversations we'd hope to be having in person in London, which we will follow up when we do get to meet later in the year. Our discussion now is focusing on what companies can do to be human rights defenders and if this is the future of ethical trade. To discuss this, I am delighted to be joined by Andreas Graf, Human Rights Manager at FIFA, Celia Willett, Chief Executive for the Responsible Business Initiative for Justice, Matthias Stoiberg, Group Advocacy Director at Virgin. I will shortly put some opening questions to our panel to kick things off, and we will then have some follow-up Q&A, and I will then open up the debate to our audience questions. So please do submit your questions using the box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. As ever, try and keep them short and to the point, and if you do, it's more likely that I will use them. We are recording the audio, and you will receive a link to this in due course for you to listen to again and share. Right, turning to our panel, let me, Celia, turn to you first. I'd be interested to hear some background to the work of the RBIJ. What was it set up to achieve? And why, and more generally, your thoughts on business can use its activities to promote respect for human rights? Celia.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ian. Hi, everybody. It's a little strange having just a voice on the phone, but I am Celia Willett. I am the founder and CEO of the Responsible Business Initiative for Justice. And before I start, I just want to say a huge thank you to Ian, Kate, and the Innovation Forum gang for keeping the show on the road and for keeping us all connected. I'm very honored to be invited to speak on this panel, which is an amazingly interesting topic about businesses as human rights defenders. And maybe the elephant in the room, you know, which is kind of COVID-19, as I launch into why I think we're all relevant to this and what the background of RBIJ is. But, you know, as we're facing the challenges we're facing right now, you know, Kate and I were speaking before we got on the line about this thing that we've both experienced, which is kind of an unprecedented level of care and attention to the needs of communities and that sense of neighborliness that is surpassing anything I've seen before and kind of unparalleled solidarity and resilience. And while I hope this time of challenge obviously passes for all of us and we at some point get to return to life as normal, I am hopeful that this sense of camaraderie and thoughtfulness can continue. And I'm hopeful that we can kind of recognize in an ongoing fashion that we aren't as different as people think we are, and that this experience can lead us to kind of break down that sense of otherness that prevents us from, you know, recognizing and prioritizing the needs of the most vulnerable in society. So when we think about like what a human rights defender is, I think that part of this is exactly that, you know, someone who recognizes and prioritizes the needs of the most vulnerable in our communities. And to me, this is a place where businesses are unbelievably powerful champions. When the most privileged in our society recognize and prioritize the needs of the least privileged, I think a real opportunity for impact is created. So my background is a little bit different from my incredible other panelists. I don't work for a business. I never have. I am a death penalty defense lawyer, and I've spent my career working on about 200 to 300 death penalty cases across 20 US states. You know, I spent a lot more time in jails than I have in boardrooms. And this work is kind of daily exposure to human rights abuses. From, you know, my client who is an intellectually disabled 18-year-old facing execution for being the lookout guy in a drug deal gone bad, to children of 13 facing sentences of life without the possibility of parole, which is exactly what it sounds like. You go to prison for life, for your life, with never an opportunity to leave prison. You know, in this time of stockpiling and bulk buying toilet paper, I'm reminded of my clients in jails in Alabama. When the local jail ran out of toilet paper, they were forced to use, you know, their socks. And when you see this, you never unsee this. And this is how RBIJ was created. It's an organization that seeks to change these systems. And when I think about how to meaningfully create change from the campaign community, from the kind of coal face, we know that businesses are incredibly important. You know, in fact, I would say that they're critical. They're critical participants in the process of change. And I think that understanding the relevance and impact of businesses on systems of justice, which is where I work, and that interplay between human rights and companies and justice systems is a relatively new space. But to me, it's clear as day that in any conversation about equality, community, equal opportunity, human rights, racism, dignity, you know, basically how we as humans treat other humans, in those conversations, criminal justice systems have to be discussed. You know, in America, where we work a lot, we incarcerate more of a population than any other country in the world, ever. No society has ever incarcerated such a high population percentage as the US right now. We're continuing to execute people right now, even during a global pandemic that's taking the lives of people. You know, I mentioned earlier that we sentence children to life without possibility of parole. That is, America is the only country that does that. So, you know, to address your questions, Ian, like when we move from conversations in the abstract about aspirations, like how should we treat people and what best serves our communities, and we try to implement them practically, like, what does a second chance actually mean? What does a fair chance actually mean? How do we best serve and support vulnerable members of our communities? You know, from my background, I know that addressing problems in our systems of criminal justice is a big part of that answer, time and time again. Look, we know that businesses must not be human rights abusers, and they need to act within their supply chain operations to eliminate potential to create and contribute to human rights abuses. But what I loved the most about this title of the panel, you know, this panel, was that it asks something different of businesses. How do you go beyond your supply chain? How do you go beyond your own activities? How do you have a direct, how do you as a business have a direct impact on human rights abuses that are happening outside the four walls of your operation? And for me, this resonated so much with the mission of RBI, because the answer to the question of why engage businesses in the fight to create fair and equal systems of justice is because of the impact they can have. In that sense, you know, the work that we're doing is a perfect example of businesses acting as human rights defenders, businesses working beyond their operations and supply chains to protect the most vulnerable in their societies, because they can have an impact, because they can be effective in demanding that community members become a priority for governments and political leaders. And my people, you know, like the clients that I've represented over the years, like them and their families and the community they come from, they can't effectively do this on their own all the time. They need support to do this. So tying businesses with those vulnerable and impacted community members is a really effective partnership that ultimately protects, you know, the human rights and dignity of individual humans. And I, you know, just to kind of finish here, like, I think this is a place that businesses are increasingly recognizing. I think businesses are increasingly recognizing this concept. You know, I am sitting on a panel with two of them that have embraced with two hands doing things because they can create change, because they can have an impact. And that is a reason enough for a business to get involved in a human rights issue. Again, look, this is not to say that this is an alternative to protecting and preserving human rights within a company's operation, but rather to say that businesses have the capacity to do more, and many are, and this is, in my opinion, this is kind of a real signal of the future of businesses acting as human rights defenders, the place where businesses are wading into issues, not because they need to erase their own footprint, but because they know they are uniquely equipped to be catalysts for change.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed. You've made several points. around how business should do things because they can create changes. In this context, thinking in terms of protecting human rights, how does a business go about identifying where its impact can be greatest?
Yeah, so I can speak obviously to our experience. Sometimes that's a geographical connection. We have done some work with Virgin, and we have talked to Virgin. You know, Matthias is on the panel about places that they invest and places that they have the greatest kind of social capital. So tying businesses to places where they're particularly relevant by virtue of their social capital, their investment in a location, is one place. You know, I think another is around thematic identities of businesses. When I think about a company like American Family Insurance that is impact investing in new alternatives to current carceral methods. They have the thematic relevance of their engagement in those kind of community-led businesses is in the title of their, in the title of their company. They are the American Family Insurance. So they're using their financial structure and their family identity to kind of drive where they can have the most meaningful impact. We see businesses with specific kind of technical expertise. Cisco is a good example of this. Cisco is a company that is going into prisons and skills training inmates on engineering, on technical skills, so that when they are released into the community, that they can get meaningful employment with upward economic potential trajectory. So I think that, when we sit down with a business that says our sleeves are rolled up, our pen cap is off, we want to help, how? We're always asking them about where geographically they're the most relevant, what thematically makes the most sense to them. And then from an organizational perspective, our feet are in the campaign community. So we're always matching businesses to like what actually needs to be done on the ground. We're, always wanting to know what are the priorities of local campaign teams, what are their needs, and how do we match make that against the businesses that are the best placed to help. So I guess to close this, I would say that civil society has a really important role to play in kind of bringing rosters of businesses with sleeves rolled up, and match vetting, assessing, and matchmaking those businesses to meaningful impact that they can see on the ground.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed. Lots that we can come back to later on, perhaps. Thank you very much indeed, Celia. Let me turn to Andreas from FIFA. Obviously, human rights issues been very much in the news, or FIFA has certainly been in the news regarding human rights issues in the past few years. So, Andreas, perhaps you can give us some detail on your work on human rights defenders at FIFA, the problems that you've been addressing, and the challenges tackling those. Andreas.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks, Ian and the team, for the invitation. Great to be part of that fascinating panel. Hope you're all safe and well in those challenging times. I look forward to the session, in particular also then to the discussion, and I'll be happy to go into some detail in terms of examples that we are of cases that we're working on, and but also some of the more detailed parts of the work that we do more broadly on human rights defenders. I'd like to briefly speak to three points in those introductory remarks. The first one is, why do we believe that the work to respect and help protect human rights defenders is crucial for us as an organization? And for the effectiveness of our human rights work more broadly. Second, how do we learn about particular cases where human rights defenders are at risk when working in to advance human rights linked to our own activities? And then third, what are concrete examples of ways in which we intervene in particular cases to help protect human rights defenders? Maybe before I start, I'd like to say that in spite of the title of the session, I not necessarily consider ourselves to be human rights defenders. At least that's not where we are coming from when I talk about our work on human rights defenders. We try to make sure that we respect human rights defenders and that we use our leverage to help protect them. so that we create an environment where human rights defenders can do their work. And sure, if we are successful in that, it means in consequence that we help defend human rights. But I just don't think that we are in the same category as all of those individuals I'm working with very closely, who defend the rights of individuals and communities locally. All right, that being said, what is the rationale for our work on human rights defenders? I think there are the two main issues to mention here. First one is really that human rights defenders are rights holder groups whose rights are at risk in association with our activities. And that's true in relation to activities related to tournaments that we're involved in, but also in relation to the broader world of football, where human rights defenders may be at risk. So from a purely UN guiding principles perspective, these are adverse human rights impacts that are linked to our activities, and we have a responsibility to address them. That's the first part. The second part is really that if we are serious about our human rights commitment, we'll see very quickly that we are dependent on human rights defenders to be able to do their work freely. They are ears and eyes on the ground that help us understand human rights issues that we may have. And more often than not, they're also key partners in addressing human rights risks we are dealing with ourselves. So we work a lot with human rights defenders, with NGOs, to address those topics that we are facing in association with our activities. So in many ways, human rights defenders, we consider them to be real allies in our human rights work. The second point I wanted to talk to is how do we identify cases and risks to human rights defenders? First, it's really through direct engagement with both local and international civil society organizations. To take an example, before the World Cup in Russia in summer 2018, where the protection of human rights defenders has clearly been quite high on the agenda for us, but also for the international public. We were in very close contact with Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch and the like, but also with anti-discrimination organizations with close ties to LGBTI groups within Russia. So all of their partners then have their networks of contacts in the different host cities where games were played. So that allowed us to build on that network of eyes and ears on the ground, as I mentioned before, and to react swiftly whenever an issue came up at the host city level. So that is one way, and probably the most important way through which we learn about cases. Second one is we put in place a complaints mechanism where human rights defenders and journalists can raise concerns. This is helping us a lot in that a relatively limited number of cases are brought to our attention through that complaints mechanism, but also because it allows us to have secure communication with human rights defenders. So it's quite often that we are in touch with a human rights defender at first, and then we move the conversation to that secure platform for the person to be not put at additional risk when communicating with us. And then the third one is really we monitor media quite closely, including social media. Ian, you've mentioned before that FIFA has had its fair share of media coverage around human rights topics. That's of course true. And it's also positive in a way that a lot of the issues that come up in association with our activities are actually covered by media, or at least social media, which allows us to identify cases quite quickly and act on them. Here again, international NGOs play quite a crucial role in that they quite often highlight smaller cases at a local level and bring them to our attention through the different social media networks that we are following ourselves. And then third part, what are types of measures and some examples that we take with respect to concretely address human rights defenders and make a difference for them? First of all, there's clearly a preventative part of it. We do a number of activities before tournaments with different stakeholders, but also with host governments around the prevention of adverse impacts on human rights defenders. So that means integrating requirements into host country contracts. It means discussing expectations with authorities. We have a relatively rigid policy framework around the topic, which helps us a lot in bringing up issues and expectations with authorities ahead of an event taking place. we ask for trainings of security forces where the protection of human rights defenders has to be an integral part. In Qatar, right now, there's quite an extensive training with security commanders on the way, where this is a key element of it. And then also we try to continuously strengthen the engagement with stakeholders, again, to learn about cases, but also to have our partners and trusted relationships when it comes to addressing particular cases. So with respect to more reactive measures, this include, for example, first of all, just getting in touch with the individual or a group that is legitimately representing that individual to discuss options of how we can possibly support. And that already goes a long way, because first of all, these engagements tend to show a certain level of empathy on our side, of understanding of the situation. And also it gives a certain, at least that's what we are often told by human rights defenders, it gives them a certain level of security that even if we may not intervene directly ourselves, it gives them additional options on how to address their situation. So we had, for example, a case of a Sudanese player who was put in jail for participating in demonstrations last year. We didn't intervene to a large extent in that case because we didn't want to put him at additional risk. But it was clearly an important part for him to be in touch with us and the International Players Union around his case, and to know that should things get worse, we would be ready to intervene. Second way in which we try to make a difference for human rights defenders on a reactive basis is that we raise topics directly with authorities. We do that quite regularly around major tournaments. And also about cases related to football more broadly. Around tournaments in particular, we set up dedicated procedures with the relevant authorities. Again, in Russia, we had quite clear procedures in place through which we could raise particular human rights defender cases at a very high level in the security apparatus and have had a number of cases resolved relatively quickly during the tournament itself. Some of you may have heard of the case of Hakim Al Araibi, the Bahraini football player who was detained in Thailand last year. Again, FIFA engaging with authorities was certainly part of the solution on that case. A third way, public statements. We do this at times through press statements or other forms of public communication, but it can also be more subtle forms of public statements, such as presence in courtrooms. We've done that twice over the past years. Then we would just go to a courtroom as observers, once in Russia, once in Thailand, to just sit there, show present, and send a signal that as FIFA we care about a particular situation. And then there are a wide range of sort of more hands-on emergency support type measures, usually in collaboration with a wide range of other entities. That may be supporting relocation of a certain individual if that's really what is needed, both in country but also internationally. So in essence, it's really in each of those cases, it's about finding the best mix of measures and finding the best stakeholders to work with to address the case most effectively. Before I end, maybe three key lessons we have learned from that work over the past years. And I'd like to stress that we are really still very much learning. Every case we address has its own specificities, and we try to learn from this experience to further strengthen the efforts for the next case and systematize some of our interventions. First lesson learned is the need to always put safety and security of those who we want to help first, and carefully consider any step along the way through that lens. It also means engaging directly with that person as far as that's possible, because usually a human rights defender will know him or herself best the level of risks they are under. And local expertise, of course, is indispensable. We may think we know what the situation is internationally, but it's usually a completely different picture when we engage with local experts. Second lesson learned is the importance of collective approaches. We sit at one place as FIFA on those cases. We have a certain level of leverage through our own channels. And there are a whole range of organizations out there that sit at different places and that have complementary ways of influencing cases. So that's NGOs, that's states, that's international organizations. So we try to work very closely on a case by cases with those who we feel can help address the case in the most effective manner. And then the last one is really about leverage. If there's one thing I've learned is that you don't know the leverage you have until you have tried every possible avenue. I think too often organizations, and I'll not exclude my own in that respect, is not acting on such cases because they think they will not have the leverage to make a difference. But my experience is really, you need to try before you know. And that is really, that approach I think has been quite crucial for us in getting some of the successes we had over the past years.
Great, right, so thank you so much.
Many thanks.
Thank you, Andreas. Thanks very much indeed. And let me turn to Matthias now. Thank you, Matthias. Thank you for your patience. Perhaps you can reflect on what you've heard from the rest of the panel and also how similar tools and initiatives are helping your work at Virgin to frame your approach to defending human rights. Matthias.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Ian, and the Innovation Forum. Really grateful to be here online. I have a feeling that this is going to be the future of conferences for a while. So I'm glad we were all able to sort of seamlessly move to the online space and have this opportunity. I'd like to start perhaps by speaking to a point that Andreas raised just earlier. I think that we need to clarify the concept of a human rights defender a little bit more, especially to a wider audience, because I tend to agree that from our perspective, the human rights defenders, and I think that applies as well to much of the NGO community in that space, the human rights defenders are really the ones that are working on the front lines, standing up for human rights in very, very difficult circumstances. I would prefer for companies to be called human rights advocates that on occasion stand up for human rights defenders, but also for broader human rights challenges. So that's just, I think, a necessary clarification. The other point that I'd like to make at the beginning is that, of course, human rights advocacy is not a new thing, and human rights advocacy in business is not a new thing. Obviously, the conversation about human rights in business has a long history, and it goes back as long as I can remember, probably the last 20, 25 years. Businesses have come to terms or have tried to come to terms with the role that they can play in the human rights space. Initially, of course, simply because it was material, it began to hurt them. Companies were increasingly finding themselves in very, very complex and difficult situations in their supply chains. And I think if we go back to the late 1990s and some of the sort of emerging stories at the time of Nike's sweatshop labor and Shell in Nigeria and so on and so forth, I think that prompted quite a few companies to take a much closer look at human rights issues. But it was core business. It was more material. It was all about managing your business in a way that was aligned to certain human rights principles. And there was an enormous amount of confusion for businesses to understand where their own human rights responsibilities began or ended and where governments needed to take over. And then, of course, we got the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, also known as the RUGI framework, that helped, I think, shed some light on this and clarified clearly the business responsibility to respect human rights. And so I think from the sustainability point of view and from the sort of sustainability management point of view, I think there's now a much better understanding in the business world. Now, what has changed and what is the situation that we find ourselves in now, particularly as human rights advocate? Because it doesn't seem to be sort of the, not necessarily the next logical step for businesses. particularly when you think about businesses taking taking a stand on human rights issues that don't seem to be connected to their business operations in any shape or form. I think a number of things have changed. One is, of course, stakeholder expectations. It may have been true 20 years ago, but I think now it's more true than ever that I think businesses operating in society are under much greater scrutiny. And I think there's a much greater expectation for business leaders to speak up on big social issues. If it's any indication, last year's trust barometer by Edelman, I think quite clearly clarified that in this day and age, society has a massive expectation of business leaders to speak up, to take a stand. I think it all ties into the broader debate around business license to operate and the sort of social contract. And I have a feeling that in the context of what we're all going through at the moment, that debate is only going to intensify. So there's a real reason for businesses to look beyond the horizon of their own sort of sphere of operations and really look more broadly at human rights and the role that they can play. Those are the two sort of entry points that I wanted to make. So on to what we're actually doing and what the mechanics are for us. I think we're in a sort of privileged position, given that Virgin is led by a founder, a very charismatic founder who has long been an advocate of universal human rights principles and has not shied away from raising his voice and using Richard Branson's voice in a number of contexts, whether it's human rights challenges, standing up for human rights defenders, talking about criminal justice issues, talking about the death penalty. I think his reach and his networks have helped a great deal for us as we're sort of trying to build a voice in this space. But obviously we're not experts on human rights. At the end of the day, we're a business. We do understand our footprints, but we have no broader understanding of the human rights space and the challenges that human rights defenders face, and the opportunities that we have as a business to come in a meaningful way. And so I think we do what a lot of other businesses do. We partner, we build relationships. And I think that's probably the most important advice that I could give to anyone looking into human rights advocacy for their businesses. We've over the years built a number of very constructive relationships with leading human rights groups and NGOs. Richard Branson, for a long time, was on the Global Council of Amnesty International. We've built relationships with other organizations, including RBI, Celia's organization, and many others. And the idea is for us to have access to what we call a rapid response network of organizations that we can access very quickly if needed. And who conversely have quick access and rapid access to us if they see a need for someone to speak up. So that's the first point, smart partnering, building the right relationships. And then it's really a mutually beneficial relationship because we bring reach and access to the conversation, and the organizations bring expertise and intelligence from the ground. And then the second step is, I think, for us to see where we can expand or build on our existing relationships with networks and other business leaders to amplify where we can. That has helped in a number of contexts. I want to give one example, and that was the anti-LGBT penal code in Brunei last year. Obviously a story that has involved a lot of businesses. A lot of businesses raised their voice at the time. Our first concern was to ensure that we understand the situation, understand the role that business can play in driving change, make sure local communities, local LGBT communities in this case in Brunei, are protected, but then also mobilize other to build a global voice of dissent on the issue. And we started working with platforms like the B Team and others, and mounted a more comprehensive campaign around this. But that's the third point, I think. It's not always about sort of loud public-facing advocacy. A great deal of our work also involves quiet diplomacy behind the scenes, and I think that's where business leaders are particularly well equipped to come in, especially if they have high levels of access. I think in a number of scenarios, it's just as useful as the public campaigning, but particularly in death penalty cases, in very sort of sensitive human rights scenarios, it's sometimes more effective to write a personal letter to someone and see if we can affect change that way. And I can say that has helped in a number of scenarios for us. So just to mirror what Andreas did earlier, the three sort of key takeaways of engagement, I think, are building the right relationships with the expert organizations that can inform your work, understanding how you can best leverage your advocacy muscle, whether that's your voice as business leaders, or sort of collective action with others, and also understanding where public advocacy may not be quite as effective as quiet diplomacy.
Thank you very much indeed. Quick question. You mentioned earlier all the different things, and I think I'd like to ask this question actually to all the panel. Is really the RUGI principles, which we've been talking about, they're very detailed, and this reflects a question we've actually just come in. What advice would you have for using the RUGI principles in a practical way for an SME, for example?
Well, I think the RUGI principles, so for the purpose of this discussion, the RUGI principles don't really address human rights advocacy, which I think sort of gives you an indication of how things have changed over time. But when it comes to SMEs, of course, the RUGI principles set out one clear role for business. Businesses should respect universally accepted human rights in their sphere of influence, in their strategies and their operations. And that means different things to different businesses. And of course, SMEs are particularly challenged when it comes to operationalizing human rights principles, because SMEs never have the kinds of resources that large multinationals bring to the table. SMEs cannot set up human rights departments. But there is, of course, an enormous amount of guidance, an enormous amount of help available to SMEs to make sure that within their smaller sort of operational sphere, they can make sure that they respect human rights and follow universal principles. I would direct businesses in that space, particularly SMEs, to some of the work the Global Compact has done, the UN Global Compact has done on human rights implementation for small and medium-sized enterprises. I would turn to some of the guidance that the UK government, particularly here for UK-based SMEs, that the UK government has issued. So there is practical guidance for SMEs that recognizes the fact that you cannot do the same things that large multinationals can do. But SMEs can also work through their business associations. I think there's some room for collective action, SMEs working together to develop guidance and so on and so forth.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Andreas, actually, a question for you, and it incorporates a number of questions on this. I'd imagine it's a question that you've been asked before. Qatar, again, does not have the best reputation with regards to human rights. What are the concrete steps that FIFA has taken to improve the situation in Qatar? And a little bit beyond that, World Cups are recognised as providing economic development naturally for places that they are where they are held. Do you now view human rights improvements in the areas where you hold World Cups as important as well?
Okay. Thanks for those two questions. Yes, I have been asked those questions before. So on the first one, with respect to Qatar, we have recently published our sustainability strategy for Qatar, which includes a wide range of human rights elements and is based on a human rights impact assessment. So I'd encourage people interested in that to take a look at it. Of course, we've been working around the labor rights piece for several years already with our Qatari counterparts. So the key human rights areas that we are working on with respect to Qatar is labor rights, and that means the rights of workers on construction sites for the stadiums and the training sites, which are developed by the tournament organizers or the host country part of the tournament organizers. They're really, given the situation of the labor of the labor code and how it's enforced in Qatar, it was about developing our own standards that are significantly higher than what is required by the national legislation, and making sure that we enforce those on our construction sites. So the work of the Supreme Committee for the Delivery and Legacy in that respect is quite well recognized. So again, I'd encourage people to go and look at the different reports there. Fundamental freedoms is an important one. Press freedom and fundamental freedoms during the tournament for people who will want to raise their voice. As I mentioned before, some of the concrete steps in that respect is training of security forces, is engagement with the Qatari authorities, is pushing for some legal change where that is needed. There are a wide range of other areas that are being addressed, but are limited to that. When it comes to the human rights defenders aspect of it, there is not a very vibrant human rights community within Qatar. So we work a lot with international organizations in the labor rights space. For instance, we work with the International Trade Union for Construction Workers, BWI. They do monitorings on the construction sites, work very closely with the companies on our sites to address issues. So again, there's reporting by BWI on this piece of work. So please go and have a look at it. More broadly, whether advancing human rights has become a key aspect of how we plan and organize our events. Yes, I think since 2016, when FIFA has integrated a human rights commitment in the statutes, and we've developed a human rights policy, there are a number of things who have really changed in that respect. First and foremost, we have integrated human rights requirements in the bid for our tournaments already. So we ask bidders to develop quite detailed strategies already at that stage. We work with them then in the preparation and during the hosting to implement that. And that comes with quite a significant upscaling of expertise and capacity within the organization and within the local organizing committees to actually follow up on those commitments.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Celia, I turn to you, a question from our audience. As we've been on Profit City on our panel today, how do you find working with businesses on human rights issues and thinking in terms of how you're defending human rights, are they receptive and how do you engage with them, Celia?
It is a great question. I think the answer is better than businesses are more responsive than I had hoped to be. Matthias goes back a long way with the work of mine, and Matthias was kind of there in the early days when we were working out whether an organization of our nature was even going to be possible. And I think that there are two things that I found to be universally true with working with businesses. One is that if we as a campaign organization can do good advocacy and speak directly to people and engage people, get people to see what I've seen to a certain extent, then people are interested. And remember, businesses are run by people, right? So when we can have businesses that understand the issues in their community, understand the issues in criminal justice systems that affect their workforce, their communities, those that they're hoping to recruit and retain, their customers, they are interested. I think the second part of my answer is that, and it touches on something that struck such a chord with what Andreas was saying, which is that very frequently there is something that a business can do that is very valuable to us. So, you know, quite often the asks that we make of businesses have considerable impact for us, but are actually a reasonably light lift for a business. Perhaps a sort of surprisingly doable thing. And when we're looking at like what those surprisingly doable things are, it really boils down to two items, which my colleagues on this panel have said so well. You know, thing one is use your voice. Publicly, privately, loudly, subtly, those decisions about what the tone should be, whether it should be public or private, I think are best decided by civil society organizations on the ground. Again, for the most part, businesses have been very willing to listen to our expertise on that and trust our judgment on that. But using your voice would be number one. And then number two is use your leverage. I thought the question about SMEs was really interesting to me because actually we work with SMEs as much as we work with very large multinational companies. And sometimes those SMEs have the flexibility and leadership structure that provides them with an opportunity to be bold and creative in what they do without, you know, 10 layers of red tape between them and a decision. And sometimes those businesses, because of their impact locally in a hyper-local way, can have considerable impact. You know, I think about a small manufacturing facility in Michigan, but actually in Michigan, in perhaps one lawmaker's jurisdiction, that business is a major employer, even if they have no operations outside the state of Michigan or even outside a particular region of Michigan, they do have leverage locally. And so, you know, when we think about leverage, obviously, you know, sort of an international scale is incredible, but I think there's a good amount of work to be done at a pretty local scale by businesses that have pretty small operations. So, you know, to answer this question, like, how have we found it? A lot better than I expected it to go. You know, I kind of joke with my colleagues in the campaign community that we very rarely have bad meetings. We very rarely have meetings where we sit down and talk to somebody and they say, nope, we're never going to care about your issue. We're never going to do anything to help you. The conversation is usually around, how is this relevant to us? What impact can we have? And, you know, when we kind of present that menu of 10 things that we believe would actually create impact, there's probably at least one thing on that menu. And so just kind of final point on this answer, you know, As somebody on this panel who has no problem with calling myself a human rights defender, I kind of don't shy away from the notion of businesses as human rights defenders. If we measure like what is a human rights defender by what impact we can have, you know, I've worked on cases and issues where I know that a voice like Richard Branson's has as much impact in one piece of work as I probably have in thousands of hours of work. And so when we consider how effective we are as a nonprofit, as an NGO, and we measure our impact as part of that, I think we are greater than the sum of our parts when we work with businesses, even when the business from kind of time perspective is very much the junior partner in that endeavor. That one thing timed well at the right time that they trust our judgment on can be that kind of Archimedes lever that creates enormous change that we, the civil society organization, couldn't have done without them. And the business probably would never have known about that opportunity without us.
Sure. Okay, and thank you very much.
Ian, perhaps to add to what Celia just said, you know, the question that is often asked is, why should we even care? Why should we do this as a business? Why should we sort of put our leadership out there in front to talk about human rights issues that seem so removed at times from the reality, the day-to-day reality of our business? I can give a number of reasons. Number one, of course, is because it's the right thing to do. I think for the enlightened self-interest of business, there's a moral and ethical imperative to do this and to engage. Of course, we don't operate in a vacuum. We don't operate in isolation. But where you have a moral and ethical imperative, you also have, I think, and that's has been steadily increasing over the last two decades, I think, a complementary economic case for engagement. So why should we care, the state of Georgia, to use examples from Celia's line of work, why should we care that the state of Georgia or the state of Tennessee pursue a multi-million dollar machinery of death that is the death penalty in those states? Well, because it tells us something about governance. It tells us something about priorities. It tells us something about a state administration's sense of what seems to be most important to them. And businesses generate revenues for those states. Businesses, through their foreign direct investment in a particular US state, contribute to the economic development. And I don't think any business would want to see their tax revenues that should ordinarily be going to public health, to education, to infrastructure, being wasted on a arcane and brutal criminal justice system. Why should we care if the state of Oklahoma sources lethal injection drugs in sort of dubious ways from shady sort of intermediaries all around the world? Because it tells us something about transparency, it tells us something about accountability, and once again, it tells us something about the state's commitment to good governance. And so I think there's a really, really powerful incentive for businesses, and especially foreign businesses, to look at these issues in a different way and bring the sort of moral and ethical case that we've all believed in all along together with the economic case.
Thanks very much. We're already over time, and I do want to ask one last question.
Of course.
Perhaps you could weave your answer, your point you're about to make, into the answer. Same question to all of the panel, and brief answers if you would. How will the role of business change in relation to defending human rights, and why? How will the role of business change in relation to defending human rights, and why? Andreas, I'll come to you now, then I'll come to the other panelists. So, Andreas.
Just a clarification question. You say, how will the role, yes, of business change?
How will it change?
Yeah. I think we have pretty much the frameworks and the broad understanding of responsibilities of companies has been pretty much defined. I do think that there will be additional regulations around respect for human rights, around human rights due diligence for companies, that will change the way companies look at that responsibility. So to me, that will be certainly a major change going forward with respect to companies mitigating their risks of having adverse impacts on individuals.
Thank you very much. Matthias, same to you. How will the role of business change in relation to defending human rights, and why?
Well, I think there's, you know, defending human rights, and then there's mitigating or minimizing human rights impacts. Andreas has already spoken to the latter. I think business needs certainty. Business needs stability. Business needs the rule of law. Wherever we see human rights disrespected, disregarded, violated, we see that the rule of law is being gradually undermined. And ultimately, that's really, really negative for any kind of business operations. So I think these are difficult times. But if we can sort of reestablish a stronger sense of the importance of the rule of law, I think businesses would very much support that.
Great, thank you very much, Celia. To you then, how will the role of business change in relation to defending human rights, and why? But briefly, if you would.
Yeah, I think that with an increased understanding and, you know, increased demand from a profit perspective from businesses to take a stand, I think we're going to see a lot more businesses engaging in human rights advocacy and using their leverage.
Great. Thank you for being brief. Thank you very much indeed. Well, I'm going to stop things there as we have run out of time. And my thanks to our panel for their insight and their time this afternoon. And thank you all for joining us. I hope you found this and the other sessions of the past couple of days engaging. Certainly, it's been a great pleasure for us to bring them to you. We have recorded them all, as I said, and we'll be sending the content shortly. We'll also be in touch once we have a firm date for the postponed in-person conference in London. It'll be some time before we're in a position to confirm that, as I'm sure you understand, but we'll get that to you as soon as we can. Quick reminder, there's plenty of other content online at innovationforum.co.uk, where you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. For now, though, best wishes to all of you from all of us at Innovation Forum.